Our first reading today is from Meg Barnhouse's collection, Waking Up the Karma Fairy. It is titled, Excuse Me, Was That a Conversation? It pretty well speaks for itself.
Sometimes I actually understand my children when we talk. Other times I do not. Each individual word they are using is familiar, but after the whole sentence has come out, I'm lost. My dream is to have actual conversations with them and for them to be able to converse with each other. This is where they were a few years ago, at 5 and 8. I know lots of tricks in life on how to get candy. I invented them, not you. Einstein did. How do you know that? Einstein invented almost everything. Oh, yeah? He didn't invent any of the good stuff, like TV. Well, he didn't invent TV, but he invented electricity, and you can't have TV without electricity. I couldn't figure out how to join in that discussion. Now my boys are older. I like it very much when they talk to me, even if right now it's talking at me. I remind myself that I'm grateful they'd like to do it. What I don't want is for them to turn into silent, hulking teenagers grunting at me as they pass me in the hall. That will make me angry and hurt my feelings. Then I will lecture, which does not do any good. My favorite times are when we have actual conversations, which are rare. Conversation happens when you say a brief thing to me, and then I say a brief thing to you that has to do with what you just said to me. I'm asked a question to clarify for me what you said, or one that asks you to go into greater depth. I may connect what you said to something else in my experience, but I try not to jump right to my experience. We can talk about yours first. The art of conversation is a difficult one. Many people lecture or indulge in long explanations of their ideas or blow-by-blow descriptions of their golf game last Saturday. I was raised to do the ladylike thing in conversation with a man. Mama called it drawing him out. The lady asks the man question after question so he can do all the talking. Finally, I figured out that this is not a conversation. I don't want my sons, when they are grown, to be comfortable with that kind of behavior, either from themselves or from their conversational partners. My desire is eventually to have actual conversations with my children, not a lecture from me, an argument about who's right and who is wrong, me drawing them out, or long-winded enthusing from them about whatever sport they are playing at the moment. We practice asking questions of one another. At the dinner table, I will sometimes say, yes, you may be excused, after you ask everyone at the table 2 questions. They are getting better at it. It still feels sometimes like I'm tormenting them, but that's okay. I'm their mom. Tormenting them is my job.
Our second reading this morning comes from Philip Halley's 1994 introduction to his book, Lest Innocent Blood Be Shed, which first came out in 1979. The book tells the story of an isolated village in southern France during World War II. During the occupation, the 3,000 largely Huguenot villagers of Le Chambon saved the lives of roughly 5,000 refugees, primarily Jewish children. To help keep things clear in the passage we'll hear in just a moment, let me add that the village of Le Chambon lives west of France's National Highway 7, which leads south of the city of Lyon. Mark?
Shortly after the book came out, I received, among my first fan letters, a letter that reminded me painfully that I had indeed written a personal, local, a little story The letter went, "Dear Professor Halley, there is only one important thing to say about the Holocaust. It was merely a geological type, almost inanimate event. No one was responsible, no one started it, no one could stop it. Le Chambon wasn't even in the war. Nothing happened west of the National Route 7 in southern France. The obscurity should be an insight." And it went on to say that only vast forces like great armies make history, make and break human institutions. The story of a few nonviolent eccentrics who did nothing to stop Hitler's armed forces mattered only to a few mushy-minded moralists like me. At first, thinking that this was only the first of many similar reactions to my book, I started sketching out arguments against it. One of my arguments went, vast institutional cruelties exist because people like you believe that flesh and blood individuals can do nothing that counts. Well, something happened west of National Route 7 in southern France. Real people with their own proper names saved real human beings in the village. And these precious few people count. But in the end, I came to feel that there was an abyss between the writer of that letter and me, an abyss that no words could bridge. And so I wound up sending my first fan a picture postcard of Le Chambon with a few words on it. These words: "Thanks for your point of view. Still, something really happened there."
Thank you, Nathan. Happy Thanksgiving, everyone. My favorite times are when we have actual conversations, which are rare. In that one line, Meg Barnhouse captures not only the status of dinner tables across our country, but summarizes the sorry state of our nation's political discourse these days. But I'm getting ahead of myself. On Thursday afternoon, Ann and I went to our friend Eric and Danielle's place to join them, their boys, and Danielle's parents for Thanksgiving dinner. I couldn't help but think of Meg Barnhouse cajoling her boys into making polite dinner conversation, as 6-year-old Isaac couldn't stop making funny faces because he didn't want to eat anything, and all 10-year-old Elliot wanted was to stuff down his food so he could go watch a video. And maybe I chuckled at that because I kept thinking about what Meg Barnhouse had to say. And maybe I chose her reading today because of what a handful Eliot and Isaac can be. I've known Danielle and Eric for over 20 years now. They saw me through seminary and a divorce. I officiated at their wedding and saw them through the death of both of Eric's parents. I've known their sons since they were infants. And as I've watched Eliot growing up, I've noticed him making that switch the children do from being family-centered to peer-centered. And it seems from speaking from his own experience with an understandable filter for what he thinks mom and dad want to hear, to mimicking what he hears the other boys talking about at school. How early and how easily we start dishing out the party line. Oh, Eliot's still in there. He's still there, but I'm often struck these days that we're really not the right audience for what he's wanting to say. And when I find myself wanting to be a fly on the wall overlooking his school playground, I catch myself. I remember school playgrounds. I'm sure you do too. We know what goes on there. It's about making an impression and finding your place in the pecking order. Status and pecking order. Oh, joy. Thankfully, the rest of us at the Thanksgiving table were comfortable enough in our own skins and with each other so that we didn't need to prove ourselves or compete. Family holidays have not always gone that smoothly. For creatures who are innately social and are hardwired for language, the ways and means of our communication are too often mired with a whole lot of baggage. Remember what Meg Barnhouse said? My favorite times are when we have actual conversations, which are rare. Now, maybe I'm only moderately grown up, but I've been thinking a lot about Dr. Seuss's Horton Hears a Who during these past months. That happens to me frequently during the lead-up to national elections. With apologies to the fine folks of Whoville, there are so many promises and rants and attack ads, and so few people willing to keep their ears open any longer. And yes, I know that's not the theme of the Dr. Seuss story, but I find myself struggling to hope that my listening will make any difference. And that is the theme of Horton Hears a Who. That if we open ourselves to hear one another, the world will be a richer place and our role within it will be clear. As a professor of ethics, Philip Halley delved into the nature of human cruelty and the role of institutions in fostering and perpetuating such brutality. Born to a Jewish family in Illinois, he served as a combat artilleryman in Europe during the Second World War. He had seen the effects of such cruelty firsthand. And as part of his later research into the Holocaust, he happened to notice a brief reference to a small, remote village in southern France, Le Chambon. This was the spark that we've become a years-long and hope-restoring project for him. Some of you may know the story of the town from its treatment in Rebecca Parker and John Buren's book, A House for Hope, which came out a few years ago, was published by our denomination's press. And while I recommend reading Halley's book, what I want to reflect on this morning is his response to the person who wrote that letter, who wrote to him that no one was responsible for the Holocaust, no one started it, no one could stop it, and that nothing happened in Le Chambon, where, in fact, thousands of refugees had been saved. It would be easy to label the letter writer an unfeeling bully, but speculating about that person's motives won't get us anywhere. We're left with Halley's sense that there was, in his words again, an abyss between the writer of that letter and me, an abyss that no words could bridge. And so he continues, I wound up sending my first fan a picture postcard of Le Chambon with a few words on it, saying only, thanks for your point of view. Still, something really happened there. Instead of a point-by-point refutation, Halley chose instead to apply a light touch, to simply claim his ground and let it stand at that. You can't argue with bullies. And the best thing to do when you're being goaded into a fight is to simply walk away. Some beasts don't need to be fed. But what do you do when that abyss, that vast space that seeks to deny common ground, exists within your own family or across the Thanksgiving table from you? Let me tell you a story that was told to me a few years ago. The story concerns a man named Fred, his wife Mary, and their adult daughter Janice. I've changed the names, but they've given me permission to share it with you. And this is a rather theological story. If their theologies don't match yours, put on your thinking cap and translate. Fred and Mary were both raised in conservative Christian homes. Fred in Southern California, Mary in Oklahoma. Fred's father was a Methodist minister of the fire and brimstone persuasion, and Fred came close to following in his footsteps. But theological doubts dogged him, and when he found what he called his social consciousness conversion, he went into social work instead. It was Fred's boss there who introduced him to Unitarianism, and he took to it like the proverbial duck to water. Soon, the rest of the family followed. At the start, though, Mary was intimidated by being encouraged, even expected, to search out and express her own religious truth. This was something she wouldn't have dreamed of doing in the church she was raised in. Her conversion took longer, but she held fast all the same. She and Fred raised their three daughters as Unitarians and were proud of the liberal humanist tradition they were providing them. Enter their daughter, Janice. At 15, the house she was raised in was not large enough for her spirit, so she talked her parents into letting her spend a semester living with friends of the family in Amsterdam, where she would go to school. It was on the flight to Holland that Janice had the conversation, that would change her life. She was seated next to an American man who told her of the difficult childhood he had growing up in the inner city and how that experience had led him to seek out inner peace, a peace he only found in Jesus Christ. Being a bit of a precocious 15-year-old, a precocious Unitarian 15-year-old, Janice responded by saying, "Well, I'm not a Christian and I'm at peace. I've never seen any need for your God." To which the man replied, "Hey, if you can have peace in your life without Jesus, more power to you. I'm just saying what I found that works for me." Yet a seed had been planted during that exchange. Over the next several months, Janice began to realize how much she was not at peace. One night, 5 months after her conversation with the man, after her sense of anxiety had risen to such a crescendo, as she put it, she thought she would explode, she called out to Jesus, "Jesus, I don't understand the virgin birth and lots of other stuff about you, but if you can give me peace, you can have me." Within moments, as she tells it, a very personal sense of peace came to her, which she claims has not left her to this day, over 30 years later. I should say at this point that Janice has taken her promise seriously. For years, she has been a Christian missionary and has raised her children in the faith that has given her so much. Janice appreciated the trust her parents gave her to follow her own course, but she saw the judgment her parents placed on other Christian members of their extended family and did not want that judgment to include her. So she refrained from sharing much of her newfound faith with her parents, and a gap that hadn't been there before slowly developed and grew. While love was certainly present, so was a silent abyss. Then, several years ago now, as his 75th birthday neared, Fred asked Janice what she wanted from him, and it was clear to her that he didn't mean a financial inheritance or his easy chair. She told him, "Dad, I want to be understood and accepted, even if you don't agree with me. I want to share with you who I am." He knew what she was talking about. She was talking about bridging the abyss. And after setting out some ground rules, sharing for acceptance and understanding, not conversion to either side, they began a conversation that's lasted to this day. At one point, Fred said to his daughter, "Janice, when you use those Christian words, God and Jesus, I can't hear you. I only hear my Father then. If you want me to hear you, I need you to use different words." And as you can imagine, this left Janice in a difficult spot. "Great," she thought. "How am I going to talk about my relationship with God without using the name of God?" So she slept on it. And by the morning, a phrase had come to her. "Dad," she told him at the kitchen table, "what God is to me is the imminent and transcendent revelation of unconditional love. Jesus is the personification of this." Fred responded before saying, Fred paused, before saying, "That was never my father's God." And so their conversation continued and continues to this day. Now, there were no bullies in this story, though for years Janice did feel the weight of her parents' negative judgment. Incorrect assumptions were long held on both sides. All agree that they missed a lot over the years. This conversation has seldom been an easy one for any of them. After all, they have 25 years, now 30, of scar tissue to deal with. And as I trust you know, scar tissue demands respect. This is one family story. Most family have at least one story of silent abysses among them, gulfs that are approached constructively only with the utmost of tact. And while the story could be called a success story, often the stories a family will tell are not. Far too often, the silent abysses, divides, gaps are allowed to become the norm and so linger, and the quality of love invariably declines. What strikes me about this family is that they knew that their time was limited. Fred is over 80 now, and neither he nor Mary are in good health. If Stephen Trimble, from the quote at the top of your program, is correct, that families change first, institutional change comes later, then this manner of risk-taking is all the more important. I remember how grateful I was when, at my mother's house in the Christmas of 1999, a close family friend said just a few words that opened a window and let the fresh air of change in to refresh us. An uncle of mine was holding forth, as he often did at such times. This time it was how awful the Y2K problem was going to be. "You should all get guns," he said. "That's nuts," the woman replied without any hesitation. "That won't help anything." As grateful that I was as that she said that she did, I was embarrassed that it took an outsider to tell the truth and stand up to my uncle. But at least someone finally did. That uncle backed down right then. And ever since, I've been able to say to him, let's not go there right now. Tell me something about how retirement is treating you instead. How's Mac, your dog, getting along? There's a gap there still, but we know we're family. I listen to him, and he listens to me a little bit. We're practicing respectful conversation. It's not easy, and it's far from perfect, but it sure beats having to shout to be heard. Thank you.